Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In moments, Benjamin Page will tell us about his research into what rich people think about politics. And at the bottom of the hour, Alfredo Saad Filho will explain how Brazil ended up in a swamp of corruption and economic crisis. First, Benjamin Page, a professor of decision-making at Northwestern University. He is the co-author, along with Larry Bartels, several times Behind the News guest, and Jason Seawright of a 2013 paper examining the opinions of the very rich. Their work was cited in a New York Times article early this week on the posse of hedge fund types surrounding Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, himself a former private equity guy. Rauner took office in January with a union-busting, budget-cutting agenda. That agenda reflects the thinking of the class that he emerges from, and Page et al. Are among the few social scientists who try to get inside their heads. Although he shies away from the term class consciousness, Page is investigating precisely that. If you've ever wondered whom the current Republican Party represents, look no further than the worldview that the subjects of this study hold. Benjamin Page. Welcome. We know surprisingly little about what very rich people think, don't we?
Absolutely. It's so hard to learn. It's just very hard to interview them. And in fact, NORC, the company that did it for us, is maybe the only one in the United States that's really good at it. They train special interviewers. They have very clever sampling methods. It's all pretty expensive, too.
These are the kinds of people who are not normally captured in opinion polls or even, you know, Census Bureau income surveys or anything. They exist pretty much outside the statistical net, don't they?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the simple way to think of it is that the top 1% are only 1% of a survey sample. So if you're interviewing 1,000 random people, you're only going to get like 10 in the 1%. That's not enough to say anything.
Assuming they take your phone call.
Assuming they even take the phone call. That's right.
So how'd you go about getting this sample?
Well, the NORC people invented a clever way. The number one problem is there's no list of wealthy people. If there were a list with their addresses and contact info, you could simply take a random sample from it, but it doesn't exist. So they used a very clever system building on commercial databases to identify people who are very likely to be wealthy, and then we weeded out the ones that weren't.
Now, this is all part of a project of a survey of economically successful Americans?
That's correct. And our pilot study, at least so we thought of it then, was in the Chicago area, the first representative sample of any sort in any area of wealthy people. It's turned out to be very hard to fund a national study, partly because it cost $5 or $6 million, and nobody seems to want to fund it.
Not even George Soros, huh?
Not even George Soros. That's worth a thought, though, actually. I think an angel is more likely than a foundation. What I suspect is that foundation boards, possibly because of their composition, just are not very keen on the idea.
So you managed to assemble a relatively small list of people in the Chicago area, correct?
Correct.
And we have no idea how representative this population is of the national rich.
Well, that's true, except maybe no idea is a little too strong, because Chicago has the nice characteristic of being sort of in the middle. If you contrast, say, southern wealthy people who are probably much more conservative and West Coast maybe a little more liberal, Chicago may be it may be relatively in the middle and relatively typical.
But it doesn't have the large tech fortunes that you would get in California.
That's right. I really hope we can do a national study.
Yeah, because, you know, as I was reading the paper, I was thinking it would be interesting to get, you know, the hedge fund libertarians' opinions on things, which struck me as somewhat different from the sample you got.
Yeah, quite possible. If you find $5 million, I'll take it.
Okay, I wish I had it. So In general, how would you characterize the political preferences of this elite group you managed to survey?
Well, I think the key thing about it is that they really hate taxes, especially on wealthy people, and they worry a lot about inflation and budget deficits. And when you put the two together, there's a little tension because they don't want to fund social welfare programs very much. I mean, Social Security is the most amazing one. That there are quite a few who actually favor cutting Social Security, whereas if you ask the average American, most people want to increase it.
Yeah, you know, they've had little success in doing that, but this has been on the menu for about 30 years. So I guess you could say...
That's right. That's probably the toughest one, but there have been a lot of successes below the radar, and there have been some right on the radar, I'd say.
And this is a very politically active population.
Absolutely. Quite amazing that we found just about half of them had contacted a U.S. senator within the last 6 months.
Yeah, that almost strikes me as a working definition of the ruling class, people who can get their senator to take their calls.
And, of course, some were on a first-name basis. They would say, oh, yeah, I had lunch with my congressman, and we talked about, you know, the bank's problem with Dodd-Frank or something of that sort.
Or Rahm or David or their pals.
That's right. Some of them, being from Chicago particularly, some of them at that time knew Obama administration people like Rahm Emanuel or David Axelrod.
But they also think about politics and talk about politics a lot. They're not the couch potatoes that you know many of the mass of the population is caricatured as.
Absolutely right. Yeah, they definitely, you know, they almost all vote. They almost all persuade other people how to vote. They almost all give money. And to me, an amazing one is that just about a fifth of them bundle other people's campaign contributions, bundle or hold fundraisers. In other words, they can come up with many millions of dollars to give to candidates, not all necessarily from their own fortunes.
So they do have a sort of a sense of collegiality among their class.
I guess you could say that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'd talk about class consciousness, but at least there's a lot of agreement and a fair number of social networks.
I was struck by how little they seem to care about climate change.
Yes, that to me was very distressing. If I remember it correctly, only 16% or something like that said it was a very important problem.
Yes, I have the table in front of me, and you do remember it correctly.
And that, some people would say that's the biggest problem facing the world. So that 16% figure was a little frightening to me.
But they do care about the budget deficit. You did this survey in 2011, so the deficit was considerably larger then than it is now.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that actually that was the point when we were still recovering from the recession. So that to most Americans, unemployment and low stagnant wages were the number one thing. But as you suggest, to wealthy Chicago area people, deficits were number one.
What precisely concerns them, do we know?
That's a little hard to say. It may be fears of inflation, but that at that time, that had to be almost entirely imaginary. There just wasn't any. I think it may be that that's a rubric under which what they really mean is cut spending so that they can cut taxes as well.
That does seem to be one of their great guiding passions, isn't it?
I think so.
The areas of government spending they do like, at the top of the list is infrastructure, and we're recording this interview just as Hillary Clinton rolled out her infrastructure spending program. It's interesting that rich folks approve of infrastructure spending. Do you understand why?
That's right. Well, you know, you could connect it to another one that they tend to be very favorable toward, and that's research and development, scientific research. I think in both cases, wealthy people realize those things are critical to economic growth. And economic growth to them is a very positive thing. I think they worry less about who gets the money from the growth, but they do want the economy to grow.
There's some really stark contrast between the views of the rich and those of the general population on things like questions like government should see that no one is without food, clothing, or shelter. The government should provide a job for those who want one. Those are really stark differences.
That's right. Minimum wage is another big one. Yeah, there are a whole series of them that I was actually quite surprised at some of those, because it seems to me some of those programs are really not very expensive. And you would think that wealthy people would say, oh, well, share a little.
But that's not the way they think. But I was also surprised reading the article by how, I don't know, you might call it broadly social democratic a lot of American public opinion is. Not that of the wealthy, but those of the broad public.
That's right. It's kind of odd, it seems to me. I've studied public opinion for a long time, and it's rather odd that most people don't actually know what average Americans want the government to do. But if you look closely at it, social democratic kind of describes it, not all the way to Sweden, but somewhere like Germany, maybe.
And then, like Social Security, we talked about that a little before. But what are the principal contrasts between views on Social Security between the broad public and the upper reaches?
Two main contrasts, I think. One is the spending one that we mentioned. That is, average Americans want to increase benefits under the program. The wealthy people, only a few want to cut it, but almost none want to increase it. Well, it's more than a few want to cut it. It's, what, 20-30%? It's pretty substantial. So that the tilt of opinion, if you think of it that way, among the wealthy is to cut, among average people is to increase. Then the other thing is privatization, that a lot of wealthy people would like to follow sort of a marketplace model of people doing their own savings and privatize Social Security. Studies show that that would actually not work out well for lower wage workers, because if they had any choice at all about how to invest their money, it would be very heavily eaten up by administrative fees. Wall Street loves the idea. Brokers, of course, want to sell stock to everybody. But it looks as if it would not be an efficient system for low-income people.
This is with Benjamin Page, who's a professor of decision-making at Northwestern University. Another striking thing was the gap between the rich and everyone else on health care. This particular question favored national health insurance financed by tax money. Broad public support for that, and not so much at the upper levels.
That's right. That one's a little more complicated because of the fights about Obamacare. So that if you ask those same questions today, you get somewhat less public support. But if you look closely at what the public's saying, really, majorities would still like something like national health insurance. What they don't like is paying private insurers, having a mandate, certain other aspects of Obamacare.
But, you know, for people in the middle and lower middle, it's hard to see precisely what Obamacare is doing for a lot of them. Some of the displeasure may be reflecting that.
Well, that's true. I think hard to see was a good phrase, because as I understand it, a lot more people are benefiting than are paying more. But the problem is they're not always aware of it. It's complicated, and there's a lot of heated political rhetoric that I think confuses some people.
And then on education policy, the public is happy to spend money to make sure everybody has a good public school and not so much rich people.
That, to me, was a really striking one, because the wealthy people, really, it's sort of like infrastructure and scientific research. They tend to believe in education, definitely, both for social mobility and for economic growth. But they've got a different model in mind than our public school system, I think. And maybe it's because many of them send their kids to private schools. Some went to private schools themselves. Some of them have the notion that if they could just make everything like that wonderful prep school they went to, we'd be in good shape. And probably we would, except it would cost a ton.
Yes, and they don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
And views on economic regulation also differ.
That's right. That's another important one, I think, particularly when it comes to regulating big corporations. We had a question about that, where there was a large gap between the general public and the wealthy. There, at least our Chicagoans were okay with more regulation of Wall Street, but they were somewhat less enthusiastic than the public about that.
And what about our general attitude towards inequality and redistribution?
It carries over to that. I mean, the average American does not, or at least in the past, hasn't thought about inequality a whole lot in the abstract. So that, you know, the social democratic attitudes you referred to are very specific ones about wanting to get help with education, medical care, good wages, good jobs, and so forth. But in recent years, more and more Americans have said, there's an inequality problem, even in the sort of the broad abstract, and they want to do something about it, whereas wealthy people are much less likely to.
Although some of the rich folks thought that hedge fund managers were overpaid.
That's right. Now, maybe we need a footnote here about exactly who we were studying. These are kind of $10 or $15 million people, which I've learned to my amazement is not very much in America these days. So that hedge fund managers who earn $1 billion a year, there were, a dozen of those last year, maybe not quite that many. But some of them earn $1 billion. That's 1,000 million. And these kind of upper-income professional people, CEOs of small companies and so forth that we interviewed, are not too sympathetic to those folks.
And within the sample, and we should emphasize this is a small sample, so we can't really get too fine-grained about it, but it did seem that there's a difference between professionals and business people.
That's right. That's right. I've looked at that a little further, and I think maybe the major difference there is income and wealth level. The professionals we interviewed were people who maybe it's more accurate to call upper middle class than wealthy. And they tended to have more Democrats among them, still not a huge number, but a few more. I think overall it was a little more than 2-to-1 Republican. A lot of these attitudes change in the same direction as you go all the way up the income scale. They just keep getting economically more conservative until you reach Gates and Buffett, basically.
You were quoted, your work was quoted, rather, in a piece in the New York Times the other day about Bruce Rauner, the governor of Illinois, who's remaking the state with some help from his hedge fund friends. What about that crowd? Are they similar to the group that you studied, or are they more in that very upper bracket that may be a world unto itself?
Well, I'd say both. Illinois becomes kind of, a good sort of test case of what happens when wealthy people get a politician in office that they really like and support. And Rauner's difference with the average Illinois citizen are a whole lot like the differences that we've been discussing between average Americans and very wealthy Americans.
Oh, now, Rauner's not really doing so well in the polls, right?
I think that's right. I'm not sure I've seen the latest one, but people are put off both by his policy proposals and by his style, which some people see as antagonistic, aggressive, and so forth.
Now, you've also done work with Martin Gillens about the policy preferences of the 1% really rather dominating in crucial areas. I mean, this picture you paint of the opinion of the rich and the contrast with the general population, this really matters because people who can get their senator on the phone have a really outsized influence on policy.
That's right. And the work that really Marty Gillens did, 95% of it, I just kind of hooked on at the end. Marty's data are on what he calls the affluent rather than the really wealthy, but it includes the wealthy. And so the amazing thing is his data show that more affluent Americans have quite a bit of influence on what happens in Washington in terms of, you know, 1,800 different policies over a whole bunch of years. The wealthy tend to get what they want, whereas the average citizen appears to have essentially no influence at all. Rather amazing finding. As far as I can tell, it's correct.
And of course, it's, you know, even in the case of like Social Security, which is massively popular with the public, the fact that it remains on the agenda is may perhaps be traceable to that preferences of that 1%.
Yeah, that's a good point. You said there hasn't been much success at privatizing, but it's been on the agenda. You're absolutely right, and it's rather amazing it has. Not only that, but two Democratic presidents, Clinton and Obama, came mighty close to making a budget deal that would have included cuts in Social Security. Rather amazing. And something that my Democratic friends don't like to hear is that the implications of all this include the Democratic Party. That is, wealthy Democrats are different from other Democrats. And the what some people call the Goldman Sachs crowd, Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers, and so forth, I think it probably pushed the Democratic Party rather to the right on some of these issues.
You know, I was struck reading the Times article on Rauner that William Daley was actually ran his transition.
Absolutely. And Rahm Emanuel was associated with him as well.
Well, it's quite a nice little club. So what are the plans for the future of this project? Can you proceed much further and without your angel showering $5 million on you?
Well, we do need the $5 million. But in the meantime, we have another track, which is to study billionaires, which turns out to be much cheaper because there's no way to interview them. And, it probably cost a couple thousand dollars each if you tried, and you'd get a terribly low response rate. So we've been gathering absolutely everything they've said and done that's publicly available. Comments, interviews, campaign contributions, and so forth. So the next thing for us will be billionaires.
And any preview of the findings, or is it too early?
Well, quick preview would be we've looked closely at tax policy and Social Security policy. And the main finding is these people are very, very quiet. They almost all make contributions. Many of them do things that are directly aimed at abolishing the estate tax or lowering taxes in general on higher income people. But they don't say anything about it in public. Very few do. And so there's kind of an accountability issue, not just a question of unequal political influence, but can the public even counteract it if no one knows?
That's a very good question to end on. Thanks a lot.
That was Benjamin Page, professor of decision-making at Northwestern. It's interesting that the foundations don't want to support research into the opinions of the upper classes. Page, of course, is too careful a scholar to put it bluntly, but I'm not inhibited by those sorts of constraints. Foundations, almost without exception, put a friendly face on a plutocracy, and the last thing that plutocrats want is scrutiny of themselves. Their role in shaping social science research is profound. Recall my interview with Leah Gordon last June about how elite foundations shifted the emphasis in research on race relations away from structural issues and towards individual psychology. From Power to Prejudice, as the title of her book put it. Philanthropy doesn't get anywhere near the critical attention that it deserves, in large part because the kinds of intellectuals who could do that work are dependent upon those very philanthropies for funding. I'm not, so I'm doing my best to fill that gap. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job, had second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin Land. A young youth, you're rocking the gold tooth. Low goose, only way I begin to G-York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son. This one and that one, pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits by high stakes, making my way on fire skates. No question, I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question, I would flow off and try to get the dough off, sticking up white boys on ball boards. My life got no better. Same damn low sweater. Times is rough and tough like leather. Sick ass click and went all out. Catch a kid.
That was some of Cream, Cash Rules Everything Around Me by the Wu-Tang Clan. Next, Alfredo Saad Filho, a political economist who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. A few years ago, Brazil was booming at the same time it was reducing inequality. Now, it's sinking into economic crisis, and its president, the hapless Dilma Rousseff, successor to the quite successful Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, is now facing impeachment proceedings. What happened? Alfredo Saad Filho explains. So Brazil seems to be having all kinds of trouble, economic, political. Let's start with just the general state of the economy. It had a good run, and now that's all over, correct?
This is correct. The country is going through two crises simultaneously, an economic crisis and a political crisis, and they are feeding one another, and the bottom seems to have fallen out. The Brazilian economy has not done so badly for 25 years and maybe much longer than that. It is a very, very serious economic situation in the country right now.
Now, I imagine some of this is the slowdown in the Chinese economy, and Brazil is exposed to commodity exports. Is that part of the story?
This is absolutely part of the story. This is a very important part of the story. In the last 10 years or so, Brazilian trade with China has grown extremely rapidly, and China has become, from a relatively small trading partner of Brazil, China has become Brazil's most important trading partner, overtaking the European Union and the United States. But the way Brazil has been trading with China is extremely traditional for a developing country. Brazil exports unprocessed commodities to China, soybeans, iron ore, and so on, and it imports manufactured goods. And this is a problem of the Brazilian economy. It's because Brazil hasn't had a decent industrial policy for a long time. Brazil has deindustrialized, has not been competitive in international trade, in the trade of what matters, goods with substantial value added. So Brazil has replicated a position of vulnerability that it had vis-a-vis Europe and the United States in the middle of the 20th century. It's replicated that vis-a-vis China. Now, China's economy slows down, then Brazil's economy slows down. This is part of the fact that there is no engine for the world economy at the moment. The United States is not doing so well. The European economy is essentially dead, and now China is stopping too. So,
this is a problem that Brazil shares with other countries in South America, right?
It is, absolutely. It is. And a number of middle-income economies, a number of economies in Latin America, most of them, are having economic difficulties. But Brazil's difficulties are bigger than almost anywhere else in the developing world. The Brazilian economy is doing worse than almost every single economy in the world. But then there are specific reasons for that, and they have to do with the economic policies followed in Brazil during the past couple of decades, neoliberal economic policies, lack of industrial policy, lack of attempts to upgrade the economic base of the country, the disintegration of manufacturing capacity. But also, in addition to all this, there is the impact of the current political crisis. You could summarize that in one expression. There is an investment strike going on in the country. The entrepreneurs are not investing. And this is the fundamental, the most important reason, even more important than the adverse external shocks the economy has been suffering, the most important reason why there seems to be no end to the contraction of the Brazilian economy. It is absolutely catastrophic what's been happening now.
Now, I want to return to this theme, but before we go on, Brazil has deindustrialized. There's been really no growth in manufacturing in recent years.
There's been a disintegration of manufacturing capacity. There's been a decline in absolute levels of manufacturing employment, but more important than that even is the disintegration of manufacturing capacity. The country has specialized on producing a very small number of knots in a large number of value chains. It has denationalized key manufacturing companies that produce know-how and employed large numbers of workers in Brazil. And the decision centers for those firms and for those value chains are now essentially outside the country. Brazil has also experienced a very long period, perhaps 20 years, of almost uninterrupted overvaluation in its exchange rate. It has been a monumental policy mistake with historical implications, and that has been the contraction of manufacturing. So during the 1990s, manufacturing employment contracted by a third. Brazil lost 1 million manufacturing jobs, and that was not reversed in the subsequent period, even though the economy was performing better. So under President Lula, for example, in the mid-2000s, the economy performed much better, but with the currency that was overvalued, so consumption increased, but manufacturing production did not. And this is something that Brazil is regretting now. As a country, as an economy, that was a fundamental policy mistake.
Now, you said earlier that Brazil shares a lot of these maladies with its neighbors, but had some factors that made it particularly worse. What are those?
One is the fact that Brazil has a large and complex economy. It does still have a significant manufacturing base. It is diversified. It has a base of research and development that other Latin American countries do not have. But it is an economy that is full of holes in its productive capacity. But more important than these deficiencies at the moment is the political crisis and the absolute unwillingness of the entrepreneurial class in the country, both domestic and international, both industrial and financial, the absolute unwillingness to invest in Brazil because of political disagreements with the government, because of allegations that the government has twisted economic incentives in a way that is unacceptable to these social groups. And the government has made policy mistakes. But what has been going on now is a deliberate attempt to make the life of the Brazilian government absolutely impossible, and perhaps leading to the impeachment of the president. So there is a political undercurrent to the current economic difficulties in Brazil.
Let's talk about the government. You know, people outside Brazil, at least, had a great deal of hope when Lula took office, and now the country is in a terrible mess. What happened along the way?
Lots of things happened along the way, and some of them were absolutely excellent. Brazil is one of the most unequal countries in the world. It was before, it continues to be, but there have been significant, very significant gains in income distribution during the last 12 years of federal administrations led by the Workers' Party. There's been the beginning of the construction of a welfare state in the country. Poverty and absolute poverty have declined substantially by over 70% in Brazil. Living standards have improved significantly. Employment creation has been much higher, at much higher levels than before. So during the 1990s, for example, the country created 11 million jobs. In the 2000s, it created 21 million jobs. Most of the jobs that were created were jobs that were relatively low-pay jobs that benefited vast numbers of people, not the middle class, not the upper middle class, which helps to explain the frustration of these social groups with the administrations led by the Workers' Party. So a lot has been achieved, and I could go on for a long time, and I would stress that a lot has been achieved. But since 2011, the coincidence of policy mistakes at that point in time with the increasing hostility against the government coming from finance and coming from the upper middle class in the country have created a political crisis from which there seems to be no obvious escape for the administration of President Dilma Rousseff. They are stuck, they do not know where to go, and the Brazilian state is essentially paralyzed by a succession of corruption scandals, by political infighting, and by an administration that is absolutely unable to regain the initiative on any front whatsoever. And this has been going on for over 2 years now, and it's been extremely damaging for the Workers' Party, for the PT, for the Brazilian state, and for democracy itself in the country.
Osvaldo Alfredo Saad Filho, who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. How much of this is a result of the personalities of Lula versus Dilma Rousseff? Because I've just been reading about Venezuela. It seems like Maduro is really no match for Chavez politically. Is there something analogous going on in Brazil?
Unfortunately, I think so. Lula was absolutely never, ever a socialist or even a left-wing political leader. Lula is a social democrat. He's a negotiator. He's a trade unionist. But he is someone with an extraordinary political talent, with an amazing capacity to bring people together and find points of agreement and then move on. He also has this enormous capacity to identify with the common people. He is, from his family origin, a poor person, and he is a working class man. He speaks like a working class man. He's someone that the vast majority of Brazilians could immediately identify with. So these two virtues, this enormous political talent and this immediate identification with the poor, were tremendous assets for Lula. He managed to be an extremely effective president. Dilma Rousseff is not like that. She's an extremely effective manager. She can make things happen, but she is not a political leader. She does not seem to have the capacity to even speak to different to representatives of different groups, to the leaderships of industry and the workers and social movements and with parliamentarians. And so she seems to have, over the past few years, no interest or ability to do that, no patience and no capacity to aggregate people around her own political project. And this has been incredibly damaging. Initially, leaders of social movements and political parties and leaders of industry and finance attempted to speak to her, couldn't do that, then started speaking to Lula instead. And this was damaging for Dilma, but this became eventually impossible and ineffective, and she lost the confidence of very, very important leaderships in the country. So now the government finds itself unable to speak to anyone. It finds itself in a minority, a serious minority in Congress, a Congress that is divided across 27 political parties with numerous scandals of corruption and scandals of other types too, affecting some of the most important leaders, parliamentary leaders in the country across all political parties. So Congress is essentially ineffective, and it is also incredibly hostile against the president. So across those two branches of the government, the executive and the legislature, there is ineffectiveness. And the judiciary is taken up with dealing with scandals of corruption that are popping up all across the country. It is incredible. It reminds us of Italy at the end of the Republic in the early 1990s. That is the sort of parallel that comes to mind.
Now, why did the elite tolerate Lula and now seem to be rebelling against Rousseff?
Because Lula managed to bring capital together to point a way forward to a particular fraction of capital, domestic capital, to show a way to integrate domestic industry with domestic demand with a project of expansion, especially across the South. Brazil expanded enormously diplomatically and economically around the developing world, and it could project an image of prosperity and an image of leadership. Again, part of the virtues of Lula himself, with operating, fortunately for him, in a much more favorable global economic environment. And Brazil accumulated some economic capacities and the ability to recover very rapidly after the first impact of the global economic crisis. But then China also recovered, and Brazil was advancing and growing in the kind of vacuum of China. China was pulling and Brazil followed. But it would not last. The Chinese economy is not only much larger, but also much more resilient than the Brazilian economy. And when the Brazilian economy became increasingly tangled up in the accumulated difficulties of 25 years of neoliberalism, then those diplomatic efforts also stalled, and the political difficulties and fragilities of the Rousseff administration all flared up at the same time. So all these things are interlocked, and make a resolution to the current crisis extremely difficult. And then the political shortcomings of the Rousseff administration make it almost incredible to even consider the possibility that they might come out of this situation unscathed.
Let's talk some about the corruption. The headline scandal is the oil company Petrobras, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But they also a top banker was hauled off to jail last week, right?
Yes.
So what are these scandals all about?
There's a succession of scandals. The Petrobras scandal is the most famous one, but there are others, and I hope to be able to come back to them. Petrobras is the largest company in Brazil. It's the state-owned oil company. It's no longer an oil monopoly, but it is the largest oil company in the Southern Hemisphere. It is a very large firm that, because it enjoys the monopoly of prospection, found extremely large oil reserves in the deep Southern Atlantic Ocean in the early 2000s. And these reserves are absolutely vast. They would turn Brazil into a major oil exporter. Petrobras then expanded extremely rapidly, sought external finance in order to be able to explore those oil reserves. In doing this expansion project very rapidly, all sorts of interests coalesced through a process of massive corruption, centralized at a very, very high level in the company, but in very, very few individuals. So we're talking potentially billions of dollars that exchanged hands through fake contracts with a number of private suppliers to Petrobras, links between Petrobras and international companies, funds that were siphoned off the company through a very, very small number of people. It's not that the company was rotten or anything like that. It is a small number of political appointees using them to build up their own personal fortunes, using them to fund political parties, and a large number of political parties, using them to fund individual politicians. So it is a scandal that has implications across the economy and across society. But the company itself, fundamentally Petrobras, is a healthy and efficient company. But it did have these fragilities that were not identified in time. Because global oil prices have gone down, and they've gone down because of the global recession, they've gone down because of the oil strategy being pursued by Saudi Arabia and so on, that looks extremely badly for the company. It looks like Petrobras itself is hemorrhaging resources. It is not. It is fundamentally a healthy company. Once you start pursuing these corruption scandals, then you identify a succession of extremely high-profile politicians that were implicated in one way or another with private firms and with Petrobras itself on the receiving end of finance. This is how Brazilian political life is funded. It is funded through hidden donations from companies and through stolen money coming from the state. Now, if you investigate this scandal, you will find a lot of the Brazilian political elite involved, entrepreneurs, bankers, and so on. If you investigate other political scandals, or other corruption scandals, you will find other types of politicians involved, other political parties. What is peculiar about the succession of scandals that you see in Brazil at the moment is the focus on Petrobras itself, because this is the type of scandal that compromises the PT directly. If you were to investigate other scandals that are also in the public domain, that also come up in the media, but they come up in the media hidden on page 35 in a very small box, you will see how the funding for other opposition political parties is done through the scandal of the trains for the metro system in Sao Paulo, for example. That is a scandal that involves Siemens and Alstom, the transnational companies that operate in Brazil that fund the PSDB, the Opposition Social Democratic Party. And they do that through the government of the state of Sao Paulo. This is widely known, but not investigated at all because this is not politically interesting. So the judiciary is involved in the sense of selecting which scandals and which cases of corruption will be pursued, even though they are all in the public domain. The legislature is compromised, however you look at it, and the executive is paralyzed because there is an endless succession of scandals. But in order to function as a democracy, well, this is how Brazil functions. The United States functions in a different way that may or may not be as corrupt as this.
Our corruption is much more in the open, I think.
Well, yes, possibly. But corruption is illegal, it is immoral, and it has to be persecuted, and individuals must be punished. But you also have to understand where is the source of this corruption, because it may be the case, and I think it's certainly the case in Brazil, that you will not eliminate the problem by going after one corrupt individual at a time, in one firm at a time. There is a systemic problem in the way in which the economy functions and in the way in which the political system functions. And unless you address those, and at the moment it means a constitutional convention to refound the Brazilian state, unless you address those problems, there will be no resolution. There is no end to this hole.
Are there any political beneficiaries of these interlocking crises?
The opposition, the Social Democratic Party, has been benefiting in the sense that they are essentially the only viable political alternative. But they are shot through by similar corruption scandals that, as I mentioned before, are simply not investigated. But curiously, if you look at recent opinion polls, no political party has directly benefited from it. So it's not just a case of political alternation of power. That would not be smooth. There is a corrosion of democracy itself. There is a deep corrosion of politics as a whole. And this is extremely dangerous. It has been the terrain for the resurgence of a mass political right-wing movement in the country with fascist overtones. It's nothing like Golden Dawn in Greece, but it's the shell underneath which a significant part of the Brazilian upper middle class is currently hiding, and sometimes not even hiding very well, behind the veil of patriotism, behind the veil of having to save the country from corruption or from the Workers' Party government and so on. There's an anti-political spirit that seems to believe that you can have a complex economy in a non-political society. That is just not going to be the case. What is the actual alternative being proposed is authoritarianism.
Well, it seems also that we've got almost 30 years of neoliberalism, and it's just the thing has gotten beyond ripe to the stage of rottenness. Is this just the one manifestation of the kind of global end game of neoliberalism, or is that too optimistic?
I think it is too optimistic in the sense that through this process of the global economic crisis for several years now, and the crisis is being addressed through the intensification of neoliberalism almost anywhere you look, I think unless there is mass mobilization, unless there are mass movements demanding alternatives in practice and making it impossible to implement adjustment policies as usual, we will simply continue to have the same recipe that we have experienced for the past several years. So the weight of the crisis being passed on to the poorest people in society, to the people with the least reserves, the least capacity to absorb shocks, while the rich preserve their fortune.
Now, of course, movements can come out of nowhere, but do you see anything on the horizon in Brazil that could fit that bill?
No, quite the contrary. Brazil is a country with very, very healthy social movements, and there are very significant social movements still in the country, but they come from the 1970s and 1980s, the most famous of them being the Landless Peasants Movement, the MST, and they are still a political reference point for the country. And there are new mass movements emerging, the movement of the homeless people in urban areas, that is kind of a sister movement to the Landless People's Movement and other movements, but they are mostly small. In Brazil, at the moment, the initiative is with the upper middle class, and it is with very, very right-wing mass movement. So the notion that if people go to the street, this must be a good thing for the left, this is incorrect. The right can also put people on the street. My impression is that across Latin America, and in Brazil in particular, we're going to enter a period of a right-wing turn that will be difficult to reverse because the social basis of the left in the previous period is just not there. It's not strong enough to sustain those left-wing administrations. So in Argentina, the more right-wing, the candidate more aligned with neoliberalism just won the elections. And in Brazil, I suspect it will be very difficult for the PT to win the next elections, whatever happens, if the elections are held as normal. And this is the good scenario. The bad scenario is a degeneration of the democratic process. So at the moment, the left is certainly on the defensive.
That was Alfredo Sadfilo, who teaches political economy at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Nosturnos by the Brazilian composer Arthur Campella, performed by my pal Matt Rubinstein. Apologies for the YouTube audio. Till next week, bye.